Jesus wore. Oh, when he wore. When Jesus wore. He washed my sins away. Happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. I welcome you to what's going to be a very empowering hour. Though moms who breastfeed, according to the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health, are less likely to develop heart attacks and less meat, less heat. China's plan to drop meat consumption gets praise from Common Dreams. Also, how important is our relationship with silence? We'll discuss that. Some commentaries today. Today is our one day a week we set aside for commentaries. Some I've written. I'll be giving my answer to the problem of ISIS and terrorism around the world. And these are merely suggestions. Also from Professor Gary Lewip on Islamic and Islamicist terrorism from Counterpunch. So we have a lot to share on today's program. Let's begin. At each of the retreats that I've done over the years, the tens of thousands of people have participated in, going clear back to 1970 up till the present day, I always ask people outside of workshops or when they're asking legitimate questions to remain in silence. And for a lot of people, this is extremely difficult, if not impossible. They have a chronic need to jabber, to talk. And then I explain why I believe silence is so important. For one, you're then mindful of your moment you're in, you have control over that moment and your thoughts. So if you're sitting in a meal and you're looking at the meal, you're smelling the meal, you're tasting it, you're taking your time, and assuming this is a well-prepared meal of wonderful plant-based foods, then each bite you're able to allow the bursting forth of all those flavors, and you can relax into the meal. Now compare that to sitting in a restaurant, having a conversation with someone. You'll neither remember the conversation, nor will you remember the food, because your energy is split. And this is one of those situations where you must have your undivided energy. And then I give some examples. What happens when your energy is completely focused, where there is no distraction at all? For example, I took a group of 50 people on a nature walk around 50 acres of the farm, the Fertile Earth Farm, that I had upstate in Stone Ridge. And during that walk, we finished, and then I asked everyone, how many of you noticed the bald eagles? What bald eagles? How many of you noticed the family of deer? What deer? How about the ancient Native American pit that was there? Didn't see it. So this time I asked them not to talk, not to think about their problems, but simply to be present in the moment. We did the same identical walk, which took around 25 minutes. And this time they saw the deer that was only about 10 feet from them. They saw the eagle. They saw the mound where these old stones were that had been a Native American camping area. And they saw the butterflies. They heard the songbirds. It was there the first time, except their energy was divided. So when you divide your energy, you no longer have complete focus. This is the latest study on this, and it's a part of a documentary film called In Pursuit of Silence. Now keep in mind, everyone listening right now, not just in the New York area, we're heard all over the world. If you live around any modern urban environment, finding that quiet spot is a challenge. The noise of traffic, planes, sirens, and just the racket of construction are probably the backing track of your daily life. And you'll get no respite while sitting at a computer, even with headphones on. Browsing the internet, you'll be interrupted by ads and autoplay or telltale beeps announcing a new message. So we simply adapt to this cacophony of background noise. In the documentary, According to Prevent Disease, made by Patrick Shin, they took a look at what happens in silence. It begins boldly with 4 minutes of silence as an ode to John Cage's seminal piece of silent music, which featured an orchestra turning pages and clearing throats, but not actually playing. Luckily, the beautiful shot, calm scenes aren't boring to watch, and accompanied by some of the quiet sounds of these locations, they challenge the idea that anywhere is completely silent. Even if there were no humans, the environment wouldn't be quiet. On land, in the air, and in the sea, the natural world is awash with sound. But some types of sound can be disruptive, others not. The film follows Greg Hindi, a young man who has taken a vow of silence and is trying to get away from distracting sources of noise embedded in electronics and entertainment. He says, "My intuition was that it was a good thing to do." And his instinct may be correct. A few years ago, the World Health Organization declared that excessive loud and unpleasant sounds pose a health risk in Western Europe. And biologically, noise is meant to alert us to danger. And when we hear sounds, our levels of stress hormones and blood pressure rise. So chronic noise exposure can have long-term impact on our health, for example, by disrupting sleep. Where at its most extreme, it can kill, typically by contributing to heart attacks. Noise can harm us in more subtle ways, too. For example, we have been losing the ability to hear distinct sounds, which our ancestors would have been able to pick up when living in a relatively silence of nature. Then there is the effect of sound on our minds. Music can alter our mood and even relieve anxiety. But intrusive sounds can affect our ability to make sense of what we're hearing. And the increasing level of noise in hospitals is thought by some to lend to medical errors. In fact, in a widely published 1975 study, an environmental psychologist found that pupils in classrooms close to railroad tracks fell a year behind in their reading scores, which prompted officials to add padding to the tracks and soundproof school ceilings. In Pursuit of Silence touches on other potential solutions to the rising tide of noise. A foundation called Quiet Mark in Hove, United Kingdom, works with manufacturers to create quieter technology. So just keep in mind when you have a capacity to be in an environment that in and of itself is noisy, to be talking in that, you're going to have to talk loud to talk over the noise. Now, you might have a background of 80, 90, 100 decibels. So then it means you're almost yelling in order to be heard. None of that is relaxing. All of it can contribute to higher blood pressure and stress hormone cortisol. And that can cause inflammation in our arteries and in our brain and in our heart. And that can contribute to dementia, Alzheimer's, and a heart attack. Therefore, when you have an opportunity to be in nature, let the natural sounds of nature, birds singing, trees moving and grasses moving, the water, whether it's a waterfall or lake or ocean, let that be the noise. Try silence, but try just eating in silence. And see how you feel about the meal and that moment. It can make a big difference. Also, I'm asked all the time, it's almost impossible, most people will say, to help the environment because it's tipped, it's too far gone. And in some respects, they are correct. We are already tipped when it comes to global warming. No matter what we do, we will now suffer through all of our lives and through multiple generations of lives with excessive heat. We're seeing the effects of that right now, and we have for the last 10 years. It's only going to get worse. Yesterday, for example, we had the hottest day in the history of Phoenix and also West Palm Beach. And in Phoenix, I believe it was around 126 degrees. And by the way, that does not count the surface area, because when the heat hits the concrete or asphalt, it heats it up even hotter. And so they kind of give up. But you shouldn't, because there's a lot we can do. The number one thing all of us can do to lessen our individual and collective contributions to global warming and drought and soil degradation and pollution is we can shift over from an animal to a plant-based diet. And when we do that, then we understand better that 18% of all of our global warming comes from methane gases released by animals. There's over 11 billion creatures, sentient creatures, that are destroyed each year from the United States, 70 billion worldwide, in order to provide meat. And the reason we eat the meat is because dietitians, and I'm a registered dietitian, and nutritionists, and I'm a nutritionist with a PhD in nutrition and public health science, it's more than one degree, and it's one day I'll talk about having one doctoral committee member, which most have, versus having nine that I had to have, but not today. But when the nutritionist, the PhD, the MD, the nurse, the public advocate, commercials, all in unity say we need animal proteins because we're getting our 8 essential amino acids, and without that, we would end up protein deprived. Well, they're all wrong. And how do I know? Because I wrote the definitive scientific study, and I did the original scientific study in all the world, in all of scientific history. I don't say that to brag. I just say it as a matter of historical fact. So when I'm telling you this, it's not based upon a prejudice, a bias, or propaganda. It's based upon what I did in the laboratory as a research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology. I found that there were all 8 essential amino acids, the same that you find in animal proteins, in every vegetable, fruit, herb, legume, pulse, in everything. And until that time, we didn't know that existed, because every single textbook that I found, including one I used, Normal Therapeutic Nutrition by Robinson, said that only animal proteins have complete protein. They were all wrong. Now imagine that for a moment. Just think. All of science is wrong. All of it, 100% of all the doctors, nurses, everybody in the world is wrong when they accept that only animal proteins are what we should consume in order to get our essential amino acids. All wrong. It took 11 years before a peer-reviewed journal finally published my article. And in that article, I found that there were 5,000 combinations that we could eat, like rice and beans, that would give us more high-quality protein than any animal protein, even exceeding that of the egg, which is considered the highest protein absorption, net protein utilization of the egg. And I had 3 combinations that exceeded, establishing a new standard in nutritional science. The fact that I had the truth, the fact that I had it verified independently in good science, the fact that it was published in a peer-reviewed journal, meant nothing. It changed nothing. It caused no revolution. It caused no people stop from eating animals and going to a plant-based diet. The same, I bet, was true with the doctor, a very wonderful doctor, Dean Ornish, who reversed heart disease in 2 separate studies published in the peer-reviewed journal, New England Journal of Medicine, The Lancet, and proving for the first time that a quality medical study could reverse heart disease without medicine using a plant-based diet and exercise and stress management. He did it. He published it it caused nothing. It changed nothing. Now, other doctors came forward, Neil Barnard, Joe Furman, Dr. Marshall, Dr. McDougall, and they followed up on that work, and they too found the truth. And outside of their individual patients, collectively, it's caused no change in the people being vegetarians versus meat eaters. In fact, we're eating more meat than ever before. So imagine that our goal is to help individuals change, but as a society, we're not ready yet. And we have to acknowledge that. We have to be honest about put your energy where you're likely to have a positive outcome rather than being frustrated and angered by having the truth, seeing people are dying of diseases that could be prevented. Even your own family members, you want to help them. You have something that is scientific, it is absolutely correct, and they won't listen. We have to respect those boundaries. We have the right to bring information to people's attention. We do not have the right to be health police. We cannot transgress a boundary. We must respect other people's rights to use information or to reject it, even when it means they will die by rejecting it. And I can speak from my personal experience of not being able to help a single family member change their diet. No matter what I did, no matter what I said, it was just shrugged off. So I understand your frustrations. But also, I'm much more philosophical about it at this point in my life, and that people will change when they need to change, when they're forced to change, but almost nobody changes voluntarily. That's for another discussion. But when we do change, when we are not eating those cows and chickens, then there'll be less of them produced. That means less methane. That means less transportation of an animal grown in one part of the country and shipped to another part of the country to be consumed. All that transportation creates carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and from the animal where it was grown, methane gas, which is 22% minimum or higher, and it's causing global warming. So anything that we can individually do to switch to a plant-based diet, we are making a legitimate, honest, positive contribution, and that is good. This is the latest, and I'm very enthused about this. This is reported by staff writer for Common Dreams, Nadia Purpus. Less meat, less heat. China's plan to drop meat consumption gets praise. Quote, climate advocates are praising the Chinese government's new dietary guidelines designed to cut meat consumption in half, which would reduce the country's livestock-related carbon emissions by 1 billion tons in the near future. The director of, general of China's National Center on Climate Change Strategy and International Cooperation said that if China's population of 1.3 billion took up the new guidelines released only every 10 years, quote, it is expected that the livestock industry would transform and carbon emissions would be reduced. Now, why is this important? Because the average person in China is currently eating 63 kilograms. Well, 2.5 pounds to a kilogram, you're dealing with 138 pounds. Of meat every year, which amounts to 20% of the world's meat. The Chinese Nutrition Society, in partnership with the advocacy groups Wild Aid and Climate Nexus in My Plate, My Planet, is now advocating that consumers reduce that to 39 pounds. That would prompt 1.5% drop in global emissions, more than France and Belgium's entire yearly output combined. But here's what we have to understand. The average person in the United States eats twice as much meat as the average person in China. Quote, tackling climate change involves scientific judgment, political decisions, entrepreneurial support, but at last, it still relies on involvement of the general public to change the consumption behavior in China. And it means that we are consuming a whole lot more meat than anyone else. We're consuming over 100 and almost, what would that mean? That would be about almost 230 pounds of meat per year. And how much do we need for protein? None. Not one single thing do we need from a human being, or from an animal to consume. So we could engage in animal rights. We can engage in the spiritual connection to animals. We could engage in helping our health, lower our blood pressure, lower our risk of colorectal cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, ovarian cancer, endometrial cancer. We can help clean up the local water where it's been contaminated by animal runoff. And we could lessen antibiotic resistance because over 52% of all antibiotics are fed to animals to help them keep from getting sick. But also, when you feed antibiotics to animals, they get fatter quicker. So it's all about profit. And then people eat the animals, and therefore they pick up small amounts of the residue, but it's constant, and then we build up a resistance. And then when we do need an antibiotic that could be life-saving, we try an antibiotic and it doesn't work. And our bodies develop a resistance to it because our bacteria develop resistance because we have all these unhealthy bacteria in our gut. And if you examine the microflora, the microbiome, meaning the good bacteria in the gut of a meat eater, it is completely different than that of a vegan, a healthy vegan. And so our goal is to get you to be healthy in your gut, healthy in your diet, and we can do it. So can we change everyone in America? No. Can we change our government? No. Can we change ourselves? Yes, we can. So I'm looking for those people to come forward and start getting rid of the meat and go vegan and help the planet. And thank goodness China's doing it. And I'll probably be going to China at some time in the next year to do a series of lectures. I've been invited to India, so I'll go to India, and while I'm in India, I'll go to China and go around the country and lecture on why a meatless diet is good. I will also be advocating to stop the slaughter of dogs and cats and puppies, and I will be showing my newest documentary, which has not been released, on becoming a healthy vegetarian at that time. So, who knows how many we influence, but I'm sure some will. And finally, moms who breastfeed are less likely to develop heart attacks and strokes. This is from the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health, and here's what it says. The longer women breastfeed, the lower their risk of heart attacks, strokes, and cardiovascular disease. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Obstetrics and Gynecology. Quote, heart disease is the leading cause of death for women, so it's vitally important for us to know what we can do to protect ourselves. That's according to lead researcher Bimlis Schwartz, MD, and professor of medicine in there. According to the study, menopausal women and postmenopausal women who breastfed for at least 1 month had lower rates of diabetes, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol, all known to cause heart disease. Women who breastfed their babies for more than a year were substantially less likely to have heart attack, stroke, and develop heart disease later in life. So breastfeed and reduce your risk of heart disease. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. For a commentary. Recently I was watching several of the broadcasts in the evening to see how would they approach the subject of terrorism. And without exception, it was always about, well, we've got to show them that they can't do this, and so we have to have more bombing. We have to take out whole communities if necessary. We have to have boots on the ground. That was their approach. At no point did they see the irony that the more people you kill, especially people who are innocent of any conflict, the more likely you are to have members of their family become antagonistic against the United States, and especially younger ones who then become very vulnerable to being radicalized to commit additional acts of terror. First, I'd like to share the idea that Donald Trump, according to Professor Gary Loop, declares that the Orlando nightclub massacre shows that, quote, he was right on Islamic terrorism all along, once again chiding Obama for avoiding that label Hillary Clinton for the first time used in similar terms in an interview with Savannah Guthrie on NBC's Today Show. She says, quote, to me, radical jihadism, radical Islamism, I think they mean the same thing. I'd be happy to say either. Well, there is where we differ. Actually, there is a subtle difference in the terminology. Islamic, used by Trump, is a synonym for Muslim when used as an adjective, but it has a somewhat broader application. One is more likely to talk about Islamic rather than Muslim civilization and art and science, etc. But it mainly refers to traditional religious-based activity. Clinton's term Islamicist, on the other hand, is generally understood to refer to views and activities of modern political movements to reorder society in accordance with some conception of Islamic law or Sharia. Thus, calling someone an Islamic terrorist associates Islam in general as a religion with terror, while calling someone an Islamicist terrorist associates the person with a political movement enjoying limited support in the Islamic world that consists of some 1.6 billion people. But Islamicism is a vague concept. There are Islamists who accept multi-party democracy and participate in elections like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt that won seats in parliament in 2005, during which it courted Coptic Christian support by pledging to work against restrictions on church construction. In 2011 and 12, the recall that the Brotherhood member Mohamed Morsi became president of in 2011 only be toppled by the U.S.-backed military a year after that. Turkey's ruling Justice and Democratic Party, the AKP, an ally of the Muslim Brotherhood, began as a self-defined Islamic party in 1983. It has since officially abandoned that term, but it was never anything like the Islamic Taliban in Afghanistan. The Palestinian Hamas, which means Change and Reform Party, which won the 2006 election and administers Gaza, is an Islamicist and nationalist party committed, in theory, to Israel's destruction while maintaining a de facto long-term truce with Israel. Lebanon's Hezbollah is another Islamist and nationalist party rooted in the country's large Shiite minority, but enjoying significant support from Christians and others. It holds two cabinet positions, and both of these quite different organizations are, of course, regarded as terrorist by Israel and the United States because their militias have carried out terrorist attacks on the Jewish state. The Taliban in Afghanistan is a Pashtun-based nationalist and Islamist organization that was praised in 1996 as a future U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, then Iraq, then the UN, as a group that, quote, do not practice the anti-U.S. style of fundamentalism practiced by Iran, to which U.S. should be, quote, willing to offer recognition and humanitarian assistance. The rule was harsh, but the U.S. did not consider them terrorist. But after 9/11, the Taliban's were tarred with the same brush as Al-Qaeda, another much smaller and more different Islamist organization consisting mostly of Arabs who had set up camp in Afghanistan before the Taliban came to power and were tolerated by a regime likely unaware of its global terror plots. Some Arab states, including Saudi Arabia, are governed by Islamicists who strictly enforce Sharia law. Shiite-led Iran is also governed by a law code rooted in the Sharia. This commitment to some version of the Sharia is the key element of Islamicism as a broad political phenomena. So Islamicism is a pretty vague construct. Even when used by journalists and academics, they're self-defined Islamicists committed to peaceful change based upon sincere religious faith, Islamicists engaged in armed nationalist struggles, Islamicists who pull off large and some small terror attacks, Islamicists in Saudi Arabia who receive billions in U.S. military aid every year. To call the lone wolf mass murderer, Omar Mateen, an Islamist terrorist, as Clinton does, implies that he did what he did in order to somehow contribute to a process of imposing Sharia law in the United States, which is doubtful. His connection to Islamicism includes some statements over the years to others claiming involvement with incompatible Islamic groups, including Hezbollah, ISIL, and al-Nusra, and some mention of ISIL in his 9/11 call. But he also was a heavy drinker. He was a closet gay person. And so therefore his lifestyle and his true beliefs, which were his lifestyle, were complete contradiction to that which he espoused as a believer in Islamic participation. So they are confused at the very least. There have been many terrorists who profess Christianity. And it is clear that at the heart of the Ku Klux Klan, symbolized by the burning cross, and Roman Catholicism was a defining characteristic of the IRA during the terror period. The Norwegian mass child murderer, Anders Breivik, pronounced himself a cultured Christian, and the Christian Falange Party of Lebanon has committed numerous massacres of Palestinians. Guatemala's president, Reymond, led a vicious war against his people in the 1980s and was eventually convicted of genocide and crimes against humanity. He was, among other things, a minister in the evangelical California-based Church of the Word and Friends of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robinson. So there's a great diversity here. There is among terrorists professing Islam, but how often have such people been referred to or even conceptualized as Christian terrorists, much less Christianist terrorist? What if some Klansman led a church pastor, led by a church pastor, beat a black man to death, and the media reported it as an act of Christian terrorism? People would protest. Wait, that's not fair. Just because they were Christians doesn't make them Christian terrorists. It wasn't like their religion made them do it. Maybe in their own minds they were inspired by some warped interpretation of the Bible, but you shouldn't hurt the feelings of 2.2 billion people by throwing around that term. Anyway, they're not real Christians. That might be the response. And because many Muslims respond to terror events and their media coverage in the same way, quote, they committed a terrible crime, the average Muslim would say, but anyway, they weren't real Muslims. Well, it's not for me to determine who is or isn't real on any of these issues. I assume both religions claim the sincere alliance and allegiance of very good as well as very evil people, with most somewhere in between. But to identify an act of terrorism as Islamic or Islamicist or Muslim and is to implicate the religion as an entire entity in a way that never applies to Christianity. It contributes to non-Muslims' perception of a religion as somehow especially terror-prone. As for this Sharia business and some Americans' baseless fears that Muslims want to impose it on the United States, maybe we should think about it in this way. Islam preaches the existence of one God, who created the heavens and the earth, humankind, and the laws to govern humankind inscribed in a holy book. Does that sound threatening to you? Perhaps it's also basic Judaism. A large portion of what Jews call the Tanakh and Christians call the Old Testament consists of the so-called laws of Moses, received directly, according to Jewish and Christian belief, from God himself. They include, alongside the Ten Commandments, a massive number of laws governing diet, ritual purity, worship practices. They require newborns to be circumcised, and they specify death for adultery and homosexuality, just as does the Quran. a book compiled in the 7th century inspired by Jewish scriptures undoubtedly known to the Prophet Muhammad. That is to say, the Sharia is basically an emanation of the laws of Moses in the Bible, part of what we call the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition. Few of today's Jews follow all the laws found in the books of Exodus and Leviticus, or would approve of any brutal punishment specified. Christians, meanwhile, generally see them as inapplicable to themselves, perhaps citing St. Paul's epistles and his insistence that circumcision and observance of Jewish dietary laws was unnecessary for them. Few Christians or Jews are asking for biblical law to become the law of the land. Islamists, on the other hand, believe that the solution to today's problems is to be found in the implementation of Sharia. Indeed, in many Muslim-majority countries, including Pakistan and Afghanistan, the Sharia is at least referenced in their constitutions as the basis of law. Now, many people would strongly disagree that that is applicable, but this Islamist advocacy of the Sharia alone motivates very few Muslims to try to impose it throughout terrorism. In other words, neither Islam nor Islamicism in themselves explain such a phenomenon as Al-Qaeda and ISIL. To refer to their terrorism as one or the other is misleading, and it is prejudicial, inflammatory, and unfair to 22% of the world's population. And I could cite specific instances for verbatim, Exodus 31, 12, 1. I could cite Numbers 31, 17, 18, Ezekiel 35, 7, 9, Ezekiel 9, 5. In Judaism, as laws that you and I would certainly not agree to, and all the Jews that I know, including rabbis, would not agree to. For example, quote, "Now therefore kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman that have known a man by laying with him, but not all the women's children. They have not known a man by lying with him. Keep alive for yourselves." Who would agree with that? Only someone who has been radicalized and who is so intemperate and so lacking in true spiritual values that they would embrace that. Do you condemn all of Judaism because of those that would interpret that section, that verse, to their own specific needs? No, you would not. And to condemn Islam without first looking carefully at Christianity. Now, I could talk about the Gospel of Matthew, by far the New Testament text with the most violent references or quotes that lean towards violence. The Gospel of Matthew is also the most Jewish of the Gospels and harkens the most back to the Jewish scriptures. Matthew 10:34-35, as said, quote, "Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I come not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and the man's foes shall be of his own household," or Matthew 3:10, or Luke 10:10. Jesus says that entire cities will be violently destroyed and the inhabitants thrust down to hell for not receiving his disciples. Or John 3:36, "The wrath of God is in all of our unbelievers." Or a book of Acts 3:23, Peter claims that Deuteronomy 18:8-19 refers to Jesus saying that those who refuse to follow him, all non-Christians, must be killed. What Christian do you know that would say if you don't believe in Christianity you should be killed? What Christian do you know would live by these statements? None that I know, and none that should. And yet I have 163 other references to the Christian Bible that any reasonable, responsible, and truly spiritual and moral person would reject. Does that mean you reject the entire book? No. You can find motivating and inspiring verse within them. And the same is true with Islam. And for the person that was up on the internet saying, "Show me one verse," I can show you multiple verses in the Quran. I can even show you what has been used in Hinduism as a rationale for destroying others who are not. So the takeaway message is this. Before we allow someone to use specific acts of terror by people who themselves do not represent the majority, the vast majority of people within a religion, nor the actual views and feelings of those people, then you are doing a disservice in understanding the religion, and you're also not looking at what really motivates these people. So in conclusion, what would be some of the ways I would help to reapply reason, logic, and common sense to our war on terror? First, we need to stop our culture of glorifying violence. The top 10 video games in American history are ridden with excessive violence and played by millions of children, adolescents, and young adults across the nation. Violent video games are even made into motion picture films that further the indoctrination that our lives are nothing more than acts of violence or for survival. Secondly, look at all of our reality shows. They show the worst of human nature. They show treachery, betrayal. They show condescension. They show emotional and physical violence. They show jealousy, greed, and avarice. Is this type of constant reminder of the base and lowest that we become as human beings, is this not influencing people's attitudes about others? It sure is. Next, stop the free market ideology that promotes weapons development as a fundamental industry for trade and American manufacturing and to keep the gross domestic product high. U.S. foreign arms trade leads to global markets that are bursting with weapons. In fact, it's going to rise 25% to 30% in the near future. In 2012, U.S. arms sales reached $66 billion, and this is incredible. Now, what was the second nation in the world? $4.8 billion Russia, $66 billion United States. Today, it's over $100 billion. And the world's largest human rights violator, the nation that espouses the most radical form of Islam, Wahhabism, is Saudi Arabia. The sponsor of more terrorist groups in the world than any other group, Saudi Arabia. The country that exercises its power by beheading homosexuals, crucifying and stoning to death adulterers, or even people who disagree, Saudi Arabia. So let's stop doing any business with Saudi Arabia. Also, let's cease all trade with any nation that is known to support terrorism, including Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Turkey, Pakistan, and Israel, among others. Close down military bases in nations where there are strong oppositional forces against authoritarian regimes such as the Gulf states. We may remember that bin Laden's original anger against the United States was due to the U.S.-backed militarization of Saudi Arabia. Stop the madness of further nuclear weapons development and manufacturing. The United States government under Obama has allocated $179 billion immediately to increase our nuclear arsenal, and it goes up to $1 trillion. That does not include additional billions for decommissioning older, outdated nuclear missiles. Instead, the U.S. should take the role of global leadership in decommissioning its nuclear stockpile. Only trade with countries who either decommission nuclear weapons as well as refraining from funding national nuclear programs. All countries, including Israel, who don't follow America's lead, should have no foreign trade and gifts at all. In every country where the United States has undertaken internationally illegal regime change, which includes Ukraine, Honduras, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, and now likely Venezuela, the U.S. and its allies, who are complicit in creating political and social instability in these nations, should undertake immediate reconstruction programs. This includes providing the essentials such as quality water, electricity, sanitation, food programs, and energy infrastructures. Example, a one-acre state-of-the-art vertical hydroponic or preferably aquaponic farming can produce approximately 1 million plants. For a devastated country with a small population such as Libya, 6 million people, 100 acres would feed the entire nation its plant-based diet. In addition to reconstruction programs, the United States would take the lead in rebuilding schools, houses, clinics, and hospitals as part of reparations for destroying the nation to have a regime friendly to its foreign policy and capitalist trade interest. The U.S. should take the lead in creating reconciliation tribunals, such as Brazil and Guatemala, instituted for violent political opponents and factions to confess and reconcile their actions before the nation in return for pardon and leniency. And finally, spearhead the creation of a progressive religious leader council to visit every country suffering from sectarian religious violence at the hands of religious fanatics to educate the population into an understanding of religious diversity, tolerance, and forgiveness. Those are but just some ideas, rather than putting boots on the ground and furthering our insane program. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening.